And joining us today on Perspectives is Matt Kaplan. And Matt is the author of The Science of the Magical. And we are here talking with Matt. Also joining me is my producer, Norma Martinez, who from time to time is my co-host. And that usually happens when she knows more about the stuff than I do. And so she's here joining us. And Matt, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Louis.
So the name of the book is Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. And Matt is the author of the previous book, Science of Monsters. So tell us, Matt, have you always been interested in science and magic?
I've always been interested in mythology, and I have always been interested in science. And when I was in school, of course, these things were taught. It's completely separate. You study history, you study mythology, you study literature, and you study science, and you never have any sort of conversations about how these things relate to one another, least of all something like mythology and science. And as the years went on, I got into university, and I started to wonder if a lot of the mythology that we have is entirely fiction, or if the material that we've got from ages long gone actually carries kernels of truth. Questions like, when our ancestors make things up, were they making things up just out of pure imagination, or were they basing their decisions to create these myths on things that they were seeing in the natural world? A really good example, which I talked about a lot in Science of Monsters, the Minotaur myth is about this half-man, half-bull thing living in a labyrinth underground, stems from areas that are rich with earthquakes. And if you were living in a world where you didn't understand how earthquakes worked, and you heard terrible roaring and shaking, it makes sense that mythology would be used to try to explain this stuff. And so with Science of the Magical, we look at a lot of things that our ancestors came up with and ask the question, were they just crazy? Were they just being creative? Or is there something here that is helping our ancestors to try to understand things that they saw but could never understand?
Well, I think that's sort of the basis of the thought of magical thinking, where I think our ancestors would come up with some magical explanation for some sort of a circumstance that they were not able to explain. And I'm also pretty sure that's how many religions also came to be, because, you know, if you sacrifice a human right at the beginning of the harvest and all of a sudden you have a great harvest, then that sacrifice must have worked. So let's just keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, and some of this stuff is totally illogical. I mean, there are these rituals that were used, ancient witchcraft, where folks would take the liver of a chicken, they take the fingernail clippings of enemies of theirs, stuff them inside the liver of the chicken, and then sew it shut with hairs from their own head, and then leave it on the doorstep of someone they didn't like very much. This is about as divorced from science as you can possibly get. But there's a lot of stuff that you come across where you look at the material and think, okay, well, wait a minute, where does this come from? So let's take, we're talking about liver of a chicken, but let's talk about livers for a second. Our ancestors were really big on livers. If they wanted to go and make a really big decision, they would go and consult a magician or a wizard who had a liver from an animal in the area. They would sacrifice the animal, and then they would look at the liver and try to divine from what the liver's texture and its color and its general feel as to whether or not the liver told them that they should go ahead with this big decision they were pondering or not. And to you and me, that sounds nuts. Who makes a big decision? Oh, I'm wondering if I should invest today. Is today a good day to invest my money? Let me go and chop open this cow and look at its liver, and then I will know whether it's a good day to invest $10,000. I mean, that's just insane. If you look at where this stuff comes from, it ceases to be quite as insane. So let's think about the original decisions that our ancestors were making. One of the big ones would be, okay, we want to know whether this is a good place to build our town. Is this a good place to build our town? Let's slaughter a goat on this hill that we found here and look at its liver. So you find a goat, you grab it, you kill it, you take out its liver, and you start examining the liver. And the details in the ancient literature are phenomenal because they were really looking at a lot of specific characters. And as I went through this, I called the classicist who wrote the paper on this stuff, and I said, look, you're an expert on all of this ancient literature. Do you think that all of this examination of livers was giving our ancestors an idea as to whether or not the land around this town was any good to grow food on and whether there was periodic drought or disease in the area? And he said, oh, man, I don't know. I'm not a veterinarian. I'm a classicist. So I called up a veterinary pathologist, one of the best that I knew, who's over at the San Diego Zoo in California. And I said, I got some weird questions. I mean, I know I've reported on your science for years, but I'm curious, if I were to chop open a goat's liver and the goat had been living on the field in the hills in an area in Greece for 10 years before I killed it, would I be able to look at its liver and know whether the area had been exposed to disease or drought during the past 10 years? And he said, oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like looking at tree rings. You can look at a liver, and it will tell you if the animal is diseased, whether the animal has suffered very much, whether the animal's had enough food or water to drink. You can divine an enormous amount of material from an animal's liver. So I thought, wow, that's cool. I should go and try this because I wonder if I could do it myself. So I called a bunch of butchers in London, and I asked them if I could come and look at their livers. And most of them shouted at me. Some of them were pretty unimpressed with the idea of me coming by. But one butcher in London said, yeah, sure, come down. That sounds fantastic. And he gave me a liver from, he gave me several livers from some battery farmed pigs and several livers from some organic farm pigs. Pigs, it turns out, are really easy to get livers from because no one eats pig liver. Cow, different subjects, but pig liver, dead easy. They throw it in the bin, so you can get those. And I went down with my editor from The Economist, and he and I spent like an hour and a half looking at livers, and it was like night and day. You look at the liver of a pig who's been prancing around on grassy green farms, and the liver looks staggeringly different from a pig that's been battery farmed. Now, neither of those animals are diseased, because we don't eat diseased animals. They don't ever make it to the butcher. But if you can look at those types of animals and see huge differences, then you're definitely going to be able to look at the difference between a diseased pig and a healthy pig, make some decisions about whether or not the area you're looking at has been exposed to disease or drought or what have you over the past 10 years. So it kind of makes sense that our ancestors came up with this idea of using livers to divine the future, because if there's been drought or disease in an area over the past 10 years, then chances are relatively high that it'll happen again. So you could make a decision on whether to build a farm or a town or do something in an area by looking at the organs of an animal, and you would come to the wrong conclusion that the gods are speaking to you through the organs of the animal. But you're still using science, just not realizing it. And so that's a really good example of some of the stuff that our ancestors got up to that they misinterpreted. But it's right there in their literature. We know they did it, and they attributed it to magic, which is kind of cool.
You know, one of the things I love about this book, Science of the Magical, Matt, is that you didn't just Google a lot of this information. You actually, like how you're saying, you went to a butcher shop to see if you can find pig livers. And a lot of the investigations that you were doing into a lot of these magical claims really did take you all over the world.
Oh, yeah. We got the so the Vikings had this mythology surrounding their sunstone or their solar stone. And it's so cool because you see in the myths that the Vikings believed that if they held this stone up into the light, that it would gleam in a specific way when they were going north or south. The stone gave them a sense of compass directions, and they believed that it was a magical object. We now are pretty sure, and the reason we're pretty sure, geologists have been looking at this now for years, we're pretty sure that they were using a stone called Iceland spar, which is also known as a twilight compass. You can hold it up to the sky, and when the sun's rays are moving through the atmosphere at the right angle, is a little bit like polarized sunglasses. You can tilt it in one direction, and it will black out when you've got it arranged such that it's perpendicular to the sun, when the sun is up in the sky. And so we're pretty sure you can use those stones to navigate. And so I called a bunch of geologists and said, you know, do you think I could actually sail with this thing? Is that possible? And they said, well, I would get some really good insurance on your boat before you try that, but yes. So I went out with a geologist from the British Geological Survey out to Turkey with a yacht, and we tried sailing with this. Turns out it doesn't work very well, but we may have messed up. I don't know. But it was an astounding experience to try to navigate with a stone instead of an actual compass.
We are visiting with New York Times bestselling author Matt Kaplan. Matt is the author of the book Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions and Superpowers. And I'm being joined also this morning by my co-host and my producer, and my boss, Norma Martinez. And we're having a great conversation here with Matt, talking about, if you're going, what are they talking about livers? Well, we're talking about different myths, different magical powers that we've read about. And Matt, with you growing up in England, I would imagine that you had a lot of exposure there when you were growing up and reading, because two of the giants there of myths and legends are, you know, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis.
Oh, yeah. Growing up, I was a huge Tolkien fan, and it made me question where those stories came from. And Tolkien was a phenomenal amalgamator of myths. He looked at so much material and pulled it all together. A lot of it was Norse. And during the past year, I was a Knight Fellow at MIT. And technically, that means that as a science journalist, I'm supposed to spend my year studying science at MIT to go and become a better science reporter. And I did that. I mean, I studied immunology, and it was a kick. But I was a little cheeky, and I ran down the road to Harvard, because Harvard's got a phenomenal folklore and mythology department. And while I was over there, I got to know one of the professors in Viking mythology really, really well, and had an absolute blast learning about all of the different things that the Vikings came to believe in. One of the really cool ones, which shows up a fair bit, because we meet all kinds of fictional characters in Tolkien, but the concept of birds in the sky being able to predict what, you know, birds in the sky being associated with magic and being able to predict the future, being able to look at birds flying through the air and determine what things would come in the month ahead, proved to be really interesting. So, for example, in the Viking myths, Odin has two ravens. They sit on his shoulders. Their names are Hugin and Mugin. And these birds fly around from Odin's land of Asgard down to the real world of Midgard, where men live. And they collect information from Odin and bring it back to him. Similarly, Odin had two wolves named Gyrði and Friki. And what's so weird is in the mythology, it says that seeing Odin's wolves is a good omen. More importantly, it says that these wolves feed the warfaring and are sacred to this major god of the Vikings. And it's so strange because for modern-day people, looking at ravens and looking at wolves, it makes no sense that these animals would be sacred, because wolves steal food from humans. They hunt a lot of the food that we would hunt. And they're competitors. Why our ancestors viewed them as sacred seems so strange. Similarly with ravens, you know, you go camping in America and leave some food out, you're going to have ravens and crows eating your food if you're not watching it carefully. So why would our ancestors worship these animals and view them as good omens? And you have to start taking that apart. If you look carefully at what's being done with wolf reintroductions in Yellowstone National Park today, the researchers, they're using radio telemetry to follow the wolf packs as they move around. But if you actually look at what the researchers are doing, most of the time they're looking at ravens. Ravens follow wolf packs around really closely, and while you can't see wolves moving through a forest, you can see ravens flying above. And so they're actually tracking ravens to find the wolves so they can then study what the wolves are killing in the park. So that's kind of cool. And it raises the question of, all right, well, if you can follow ravens to a wolf kill, could you then, you know, take some spears and shoo the wolves off and steal their meat? And the answer to that question is a definitive yes. But the bigger question is whether our ancestors did that. If you look in Africa today, you've got a lot of tribes like the Hadza who follow vultures to lion kills. And then they do something called power scavenging, where they take spears and they work as a group to shoo lions off of freshly killed meat. And then they steal the meat and run back to their camps. We don't know what the Vikings actually did, but the concept of Vikings being able to follow ravens to wolf kills, shoo the wolves away and steal the meat, and then run back to camp with the meat, is not that different from what the Hadza do today. And so you ask the question of, it says the wolves will feed the warfaring of Odin, and that the ravens are sacred, and that you must never lose sight of the ravens. This is what the mythology all reports. So is that just because people came up with the idea that ravens and wolves are cool and they should worship them? Or was there a more ancient connection based upon scavenging of food from wolves? Were they following the ravens to wolf kills, stealing the meat, bringing it back to camp, and then coming to the conclusion that the ravens and the wolves were the sacred animals of their all-father god who was providing for them? And so it makes sense that you would get the mythology. As it turns out, I chased after ravens and wolves in Yellowstone for a while this past year. And you really can follow ravens to wolves, even if you're an untrained numpty like me. I went out and, okay, fine. The first ravens went to garbage dumpsters, and that was a little less than inspiring. That was depressing. But after the first couple of dumpster visits, I saw a raven go up into the air, and my friend Charlie was with me, and we're driving along, not very safely, looking up in the air, like, oh, there it goes, oh, oh, oh. And then I said, oh, Charlie, look, the ravens met with another raven. And we're following now three ravens flying through the sky, and they begin circling. And we looked, we're trying to see what this is. We parked the car, started walking up, and suddenly we crest the top of the hill, and there are all these people up top. And they've all got their binoculars out to where the ravens were circling that we had just followed. And I said, what are you looking at? And they said, oh, there are three wolves that have just attacked an elk. It's looking pretty bad. We think it's going to fall in the next few hours. So in this case, without really trying very hard, I mean, we did this in just one day with no training. Charlie and I followed ravens to a wolf kill in Yellowstone National Park. And if it was legal, we would have been able to take our spears, if we had spears, and walk up to the wolves and shoo them away and steal some freshly slain elk and have that for supper. We didn't, because, you know, there are laws against that in national parks. But it was amazing. I couldn't believe we were able to do that.
You know, and going back to birds, there's another interesting part in your book where bird migration patterns during an El Nino or El Nina weather pattern can actually predict disease. How far does that go back?
Well, we know that our ancestors were looking at birds to predict the future. And we know that in Greece, because we've got it in their literature, it says that if the bird goes to the right, then that's a bad sign. If it goes to the left, then that's a good sign. And that seems so ambiguous, because if you're looking up in the air, left, right, what does it matter? If you look at the literature, it actually says you need to be facing north before you make that decision. So what you're really doing is deciding whether the bird is going east or west. And if you are studying the migration of specific bird species, the birds that are traveling from Europe south for the winter, they have a choice. They can either go via Spain over Gibraltar and south into Africa, or they can go via Turkey and Syria and Israel into Africa. And it turns out that the direction that birds go depends upon the North Atlantic climate system. It's called the North Atlantic Oscillation, which we think is somewhat related to what's going on with the El Niño, La Niña climate change, climate systems. Although I should take a step back here. We know without any question in California that when you have El Niño or La Niña, this changes temperatures, it changes rainfall, it changes so much. And among the many things that it will change, it changes the pathways that birds take while they're migrating, because birds are lazy. They will take the path of least resistance to their migrating grounds. And what they'll look for are areas that are hot, where they can find thermals, hot air rising off the ground, so that they can just glide effortlessly southwards rather than having to flap a lot. This same sort of situation happens in Europe. If you've got different forms of the North Atlantic Oscillation taking place, you can have the air around Spain being particularly warm, such that birds will preferentially go that way, or the air around Turkey being particularly warm, in which case birds will go in that direction. So you can determine what kind of climate system you're in based upon which way birds are migrating during a given year. That alone is pretty cool, because that would tell you, okay, the birds are going towards Turkey. That means we're going to get a lot of rain this year. That means we're probably going to get good crops. So this is a good omen. Whereas if they go by, I'm pulling this out of my head, I can't remember the specific details of it. If they go via Spain, then that could be a bad year. But it gets more interesting than that, because as a team, see, it's Jeffrey Shaman at Columbia University and Mark Lipsitch at Harvard University who explained that depending upon what kind of El Niño or La Niña system we have in a given year, that controls pathways that birds take in Asia and whether they're coming into contact with lots of pigs on farms, and that leads to trend, and it depends upon how much rainfall happens in Asia. And when you have lots of rainfall on pig farms and birds are spending more time in the area, you increase the chances of viruses jumping from swine to birds, and that this has an overall effect on disease transmission around the world, because then those birds go back migrating to Europe and Russia and Africa. They go all over the place. And so the team, and this is far from proven, published in Proceedings of the National Academy a couple of years back, that we can look at the really big influenza epidemics of the past 100 years, and they are linked to specific moments of El Niño systems in the Pacific. And that's not proof that that's what's actually happening. But they were able to point out that there appears to be this correlation. And that's kind of cool, because it suggests that, you know, far away from being able to look at birds and say, oh, we're going to have good rain this year, you could look at which way birds are migrating and also say, we're probably going to get a lot of disease this year too. And you have to wonder whether our ancestors were picking up on that. And we don't know, but we can look at the myths and say, well, they were certainly looking at birds, and they certainly believed that looking at bird migrations was important, but how much did they know? I think they knew about climate and rainfall. I think they were using the birds for that purpose. Whether they knew about disease is more open question, but it's certainly one that's worth thinking about.
We're talking to Matt Kaplan, author of Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. And Matt, I don't know if you were anything like me. When I was growing up, I was fascinated by the supernatural, by magic, by horror. However, I'm also a skeptic. And to me, the explanations behind some of these supposedly unexplainable experiences, to me, are even more fascinating than the actual claims themselves. And that's why I was really excited to read your book, which sort of investigates some of the more ancient myths, like the oracles. You know, I remember specifically something in your book about caves, and there are so many caves in Europe, in Italy and in Turkey, and a lot of these myths developed in these caves where there are these noxious, toxic gases that, you know, can kill in no time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the places that are associated with legend as being gateways to the dead, it's not an accident that most of the caves that our ancestors believed would lead them to Hades or the underworld were places where there were a lot of toxic fumes. You walk in and you will drop dead. And many of these are still active today, so you can look at it and say, oh, wow, okay. It doesn't take very much creativity at all, and I'm not the first one to come up with this kind of stuff. People saying, oh, yeah, our ancestors decided this was the gateway to the underworld, because if you walk into this cave, you will drop dead. So they came up with the conclusion that, oh, this place is strong with the dark side of the force, as it were. And that seems entirely logical. I think with regards to the skepticism, I really wanted to cover science of magical things because I have such a passion for it. But as a science correspondent, I'm so used to covering things that are peer-reviewed and academically tested, I really didn't want to wade into this very murky territory unless I was as skeptical can be. And I tried very hard throughout the book to point out that I actually was testing a lot of this stuff to see whether or not our ancestors were onto something. And I like to give our ancestors credit for being a lot smarter than many other people do and not assuming that they were morons. But I also like to be very cautious in saying, okay, they definitely believed this. So with the poison gases and the entry to the underworld, I think we have the strongest case possible under those circumstances because we still have the cave. The geology is still very active. It's still totally toxic. You will drop dead almost immediately if you walk into it. And what's particularly exciting, by the way, about that site is the dark side of the force is stronger at night than it is at day because sunlight energizes the particles in the area and causes the CO2 to dissipate more readily. So you can walk closer to the cave and not die at daytime than you can at night, which I just think is so cool because we associate the underworld gods with darkness and shadow. And I think that makes a lot of sense from an aesthetic perspective. But in this case, the chemistry of the toxic fumes from the cave is related to the sunlight versus darkness, and it come out more fully at night, which I thought was pretty awesome. But I think you've got a very strong case for saying that our ancestors really came to this conclusion based upon their experiences, because we still have the thing there today. But if you look at, for example, the Oracle at Delphi, we've got some really good geology where they've looked at gases that got contained within sedimentary rock and incrustations around the sides of the cave where the priestess, the Oracle of Delphi, spent her time. And several scientists have come to the conclusion the oracle was being exposed to ethylene vapors, which led her to have visions. And you can look at the rock and say, oh, well, yeah, the rock definitely encased ethylene vapors. There was a spring here that was bringing up ethylene fumes. And if you breathe those, they would get you pretty happy and have you, you know, possibly having some very interesting experiences that people in ancient times would view as magical.
And superpowers is one of the words that's in the subtitle to this book. And it's no secret once you start reading this book that I think you're a Marvel Comics fan because you bring up a lot of Marvel comic book characters in this to sort of bring up as a parallel or a metaphor to some of the ideas that you're bringing forth. You talk a lot about the X-Men, plus you also bring in a few Star Wars references. You reference some movies. So I'm guessing you're a big fan of pop culture, Matt?
I am a huge pop culture fan, but there's another side to this. And we come to the conclusion that all of the mythology is ancient and that that's the only place where you're going to find any sort of recording of our explorations of the natural world. But that's entirely not true. If you look at, for example, the X-Men comics, let's take a look at those. The X-Men comics all appear in 1963. This is the moment when we really see X-Men come into its own. And it's Lyndon Johnson dealing with civil rights legislation in a very big way. You have got the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is even in one of the X-Men films. X-Men First Class specifically deals with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But nuclear radiation is very big on everyone's minds. Everyone is very scared about radiation and what it can do. Similarly, people are dealing with civil rights issues in America and whether or not it's these concepts of separate and equal are acceptable and how you deal with people who are different from you. And it all comes out in the X-Men comic books in 1963 because it was on everyone's mind and people wanted to talk about it and think about it. And so X-Men are very much about, you know, being different and also being exposed to radiation because X-Men were originally known for, wait for it, Children of the Atom. That's what they were called. And it was in association with radiation. Similarly, the Incredible Hulk comes to be the Incredible Hulk because of gamma radiation. Spider-Man comes to be the Spider-Man because he's bit by a radioactive spider. Sure, the recent movies show him being bit by a transgenic spider, but that actually is just a case in point because our mythology, our modern mythology, is changing to deal with different concerns and interests. We were really worried about atomic radiation in the 60s, so that's where our myths went. Now we're much more concerned about transgenics, and that's what we're seeing in the modern Spider-Man. Similarly, Jurassic World this past summer, it was not about recreating dinosaurs anymore. It was about creating a genetically engineered dinosaur that wasn't a dinosaur anymore, that could become a cold-hearted killer and become very intelligent and very dangerous. So we don't have mythology in the classic sense that the Greeks did, but our pop culture is very much a modern reflection of that stuff. And so I'm trying to help readers to realize that this is not just old stuff. This is still a very modern behavior to look at the world around us and to then use our fiction to talk about it, to explore it, and to think about it. And so Captain America deals with eugenics and using drugs to alter the body. This is very much a real-world issue, specifically with things like the Olympics, where people are using viruses to shepherd genes into the body that can shape the way we work and make us more effective athletes. Is that legal? Should it be legal? How much can be done? Could you turn someone into a super soldier?
Well, Matt, we're out of time, and unfortunately, we can't talk about how Adam and Eve probably dropped mushrooms or, you know, the possible explanations to the biblical plagues in Egypt. So we're just going to have to invite people to pick up Science of the Magical, from the Holy Grail to love potions to superpowers.
Or invite you back.
That's right.
Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking with both of you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. And I hope the security guard's not worried about your health being locked up in there for a long time.
Just hoping not.
All right. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thanks a lot.
We've been visiting with Matt Kaplan. Matt is the author of the book Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. He is also the author of the previous book, The Science of Monsters. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, DJ Orozco, and our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sainz.